Today on Against the Grain, police killings are in the news these days. We're told that the police are imperfect, but that if we make the right reforms, the bad apples will be weeded out and aggressive behavior no longer tolerated. But, as David Correa argues, what if the police are not reformable? What if the system of policing is the problem, and that it's obscured by the language in which we talk about the police? From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. From community policing to body cameras to implicit bias training, there's no end of reform ideas for reining in the brutality of the police. But what if that brutality were central to the institution itself, not something that could be reformed away? In Police, a Field Guide, published by Verso, David Correa and his co-author Tyler Wall look at the language of police and police reform, from weaponry to police values. They argue that policing is not about public safety, but about imposing social order under capitalism. Correa is associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and joins me now from Albuquerque. David, what is cop speak and why should we be wary of it?
In my view, cop speak is what makes it impossible to have any kind of conversation about police that isn't one patrolled by police, because you know most of the words we use to talk about police, threat, emergency, discretion, tear gas, taser, order, security, you name it, are all words that come to us defined already by police. And this is a language, even if some of us have other definitions, this mainstream or establishment definition is a kind of language that Tyler and I call cop speak, which means that ultimately we're always talking about police the way police want us to talk about police, which is, you know, is a world imagined as full of threats and emergencies and one that requires some sort of specialized and armed branch of the state to patrol to guarantee safety and security, and that armed branch of the state is police, and there it can be no democracy and there can be no order without police. And so this whole language, you know, is we refer to as cop speak as a way to sort of name it. This is an actual language. It has its own vernacular and has very specific kinds of definitions of terms and concepts. And if we don't get underneath those and really try to understand what it is police mean when they talk of threats and emergencies and what we ought to mean instead when we talk about it, it's really easy to fall into what I think is a trap. And it's the trap is police reform. I mean, that's the trap. And there can be no police reform as we know it without cop speak. With cop speak, police reform is an entire politics of that ends with more police and more weapons, and just promising that those cops will be nicer and they'll be better trained and they won't be shooting young black men in the back, or they won't be assaulting and killing young homeless Native women in the streets. That's just an aberration. And when we refuse cop speak, then we can see police for what it really is, which is the racialized sociospatial control of the poor. And that's what we're trying to do in the book, is offer an antidote to cop speak so that activists or anyone who really cares about confronting the very real ongoing and historical problem of police violence without having to rely on the language police give us to do that.
And we'll talk more as we go on about police reform and the perils of police reform as you see it. Why is policing the poor so central to capitalism and therefore so central to the police?
Our book is mostly about North America for the most part, the U.S. specifically. But we try to think a little bit transnationally in the book. And so if you're thinking about police and the origins of police, particularly in the European context, it entirely emerges out of the transition from feudalism to capitalism and this desperate need to organize this suddenly mobile poor, right, released from the bondage of feudalism, and that sort of version of liberty that comes with the transition to capitalism also comes with it, you know, great sort of like logistical and organizational problems for capitalism. Like we have those vagrants, as they were called, you know, have to be made available for wage labor, and it's police, you know, as the logic that organizes this. And so, you know, in the European context, police emerge out of this need to organize the poor, to be made available as this sort of reserve army, as Marx would call them, and become wage laborers, like disciplined into wage laborers. That's true also in the U.S., where the police are, you know, are really preoccupied with, you know, property and defending property rights and enforcing property rights. There really can't be a capitalism without police, because the property relations at the heart of capitalism have to be enforced. There is no property without enforcement, and enforcement requires violence, and there has to be a legitimate violence that the state can rely on to enforce those particular social relations and conditions that make capitalism possible. So there has to be a police. And by the way, it doesn't have to be a public police, right? I mean, historically in the U.S., police have often been and still are largely private, paid for privately to serve private economic interests, to reinforce those property relations, so that there actually can be the property relations necessary for capitalism. That's what police are and always will be and always have been. In the U.S. context, though, it also comes out of the slave patrols and the settler colonial militias that, of course, can't be separated from questions of property, but also, I think, are very much about, you know, police are defending an order of property, but also patrolling a racial line in the U.S.
Yes, tell us more about how the police, who are ubiquitous in all sorts of societies around the world, what kind of policing do we tend to see in settler colonial states, and why?
Well, you know, I think there is something unique about the policing in settler colonial states like the U.S. or Canada or Australia or New Zealand or Israel, and it has everything to do with a particular kind of spatial control of the indigenous body. I live in Albuquerque, and Albuquerque is a border town, borders on Pueblos and the Navajo Nation, and it's not an accident that indigenous people, when they come into contact with police, are often told, go back to the reservation. I mean, I've done interviews with native homeless people in Albuquerque who tell me, like, that's what we hear when we come into contact with cops. And you know, Shireen Razick's written a brilliant book called Dying from Improvement about, colonial policing in Canada, you know, identifies this sort of the same process whereby the, you know, the present, the sort of indigenous presence is actually a kind of accusation, you know, that the settler colonial project is ongoing and unfinished, and it is the police that have to make that indigenous body invisible, right? They have to always be invisible. Their mere presence is a crime. And, you know, I've been to, you know, hearings by the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission where, you know, one native person after another comes up to give testimony, and it, you know, it's like literally walking down the street becomes fraught with all kinds of problems for native people in the city because they're constantly being pulled over, they're constantly being harassed by cops, and it's because in settler colonial states, the whole project, the whole settler colonial project, is the elimination of the native and the claimed native land. And that's a police project. That's always been a police project. And it's an ongoing police project. And you know, I think it's more obvious when you're in a border town like Albuquerque or Gallup, New Mexico, or Rapid City, South Dakota, or Saskatoon, Canada. But it's true everywhere else as well in settler states. And, you know, so the slave patrol and the militia are the first cops in the U.S. And, you know, all the terms that we use to describe and talk about police come to us from the slave patrol or the colonial militia. The patrol, right, is a word that sort of the origins of the word come to us from the slave patrol. They were very specific and referred to the policing and control of slaves, enslaved Africans and native people. And it might not be true to draw a direct line from the slave patrol or the colonial militia to contemporary police. But, you know, that's the model. That's the model that all contemporary policing emerges from.
In your book, one of the dimensions of policing that you explore is that of the values of policing and the police. And I wanted to ask you about the key value of order and its flip side, disorder. What do those mean, and why are they so important in understanding policing?
Well, you know, order might be the most important concept to understand police. It's not usually the concept that we turn to. It's one of the reasons why police are so difficult to talk about and understand, because the fallback way we usually think about police or are told to think about police is as crime fighters and as as law enforcement. But, you know, police, there's very little that police do that's actually related to crime. It's all about order, the imposition or the fabrication of order itself, and the idea that cops inhabit or patrol the thin blue line between order or disorder, civilization, savagery. These are binaries that police, you know, defend. Police are very, very explicit about this. I mean, you know, if anyone has any familiarity with police, you know, you're probably familiar with William Bratton, who is the police chief in L.A. and mm-hmm. Boston and New York, and his theory of broken windows policing, which he took from some sociologists, you know, who sort of elaborated this theory of broken windows. And it's very explicitly about, hey, you know, cops are not about crime prevention or enforcement or law enforcement. Police impose order, and theirs was a very normative order about, like, the property owners or the heterosexual, you know, male and female couple with children, and the city's for them. And the job of the cop is to really patrol that city and make sure that the vagrants are kept in their place and the city is made safe for, you know, for people who belong there. And I mean, it's throughout the book, you know, we draw quite a bit on this because we're trying to point out that this is not some sort of, like, hidden agenda. This is out in the open among police and police reformers. And, so when we're talking about police, we better start by saying, well, what is the order, then, that police impose? And it's an absolutely racialized order, and it's a propertied order. And there's really, therefore, nothing that a cop can do or police can do that any court would later find fault with, as long as it's in service to that order, that normative order of property, defending a racial line, serving normative values that police define on the street. You know, they're the administrative authority on the street at any given time, and cops have wide discretion, really unlimited discretion, to decide what to do, how to confront a problem that they identify as a problem. No court's going to come in after the fact and say, that cop maybe shouldn't have had that discretion to make the decision that he or she made. They might, and very occasionally do, say that some decision a cop made was not the right decision, but that doesn't change the fact that the person maybe they killed is still dead, that the injury they caused can't be undone. So, you know, in the book we call that unlimited. Like, the cops have unlimited discretion to make decisions on, you know, what is an emergency, who is a threat, and how do I, as a police officer, respond to that threat. And that's all about order. That's not about crime fighting or law enforcement. That's just about order. And you see that. I mean, I think that the video that we recently saw about Alton Sterling, right, and the way the cop was very sort of clearly talking about a kind of an expectation of behavior. You don't belong here, and you're not behaving the way I want you to behave, and there are consequences for that. The way that the cop dealt with Sandra Bland, right? That you know, you're not behaving appropriately. You don't belong here. These are not aberrations. These are not bad apple cops. This is how policing is done, because it's about imposing a normative and racialized order. And so we have to start, at least we think that we have to start with the concept of order to really get at what it is police do, what kind of institution it is in society, and how it works.
I'm speaking with David Correa about his co-authored book, Police, A Field Guide. My name is Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in terms of thinking about the order that the police impose, is the notion of order as defined by the police one holy that comes on high, or is there also some notion of the specter of disorder that this order is supposed to keep a lid on?
Well, yeah, that's one of the sort of hallmarks of cop speak, is this idea that there is always disorder lurking around every corner. You know, that, I mean, really every concept, if you break apart every concept that cops rely on, whether it's jurisdiction or discretion or threat or emergency, you know, buried within all of those is this idea that but there is great disorder without police. And it's a very specific kind of police, right? I mean, the version that we have is this absolutely necessary version. We're taught that there literally is no democracy without police. Without police, we don't live in a free society. So liberal democracy requires police. And so therefore there's no alternative, right? So in these shocking examples of police violence, such as on March 18th in Sacramento with the killing of Stephon Clark, our reaction of anger really can only just resolve into acceptance. Well, what can we do? I guess it's not like we can abolish police, so we just have to have better training, and maybe we have to figure out a way to make sure that these things don't happen in the future. And there's all kinds of, you know, reformists are always ready to offer the same and similar kinds of suggestions to do that. And it's always premised on the idea that, well, you know, we're going to make some mistakes, and we're sorry to the family of Stephon Clark, but, you know, I mean, we have to engage in this form and kind and mode of policing, or else we're going to have incredible disorder. There's no alternative. I wouldn't say that this is something that that police hold dear and the rest of us look on with skepticism. I think it's widely held belief, whether we're talking about really anywhere on the political spectrum, conservatives and liberals alike share this idea that, you know, police are absolutely necessary. And so if police are necessary, then we're sort of left with this idea of relying on police reform and these sort of familiar things about, like, calling the cops that do these bad things bad apples, and considering this all an aberration, and really exonerating the institution itself and focusing our attention on individual cops, because it's the institution that guarantees our safety and security, and it's a few bad apples that make it difficult for us to understand how cops can be better. And that is all designed. I mean, we try to really focus on that in the book to demonstrate the way in which that doesn't just exonerate the institution itself from responsibility for the actions of individual cops, but it exonerates the institution from any scrutiny. Right? I mean, it's just, there's nothing we can do. We need police because without it, it'll be barbarism and savagery and anti-civilization, and therefore we have to hold fast to this commitment we have to police. Really, everything cops do and everything police reform does is about restoring this faith in police, Because without it, right, without that faith in police, that institution then suddenly is open to question, and we can start asking after possible alternatives. And is there some other way that maybe our safety and security could be ensured?
What's interesting, though, is that although one can see particular populations being particularly prone to the notion that the police are protecting them from savagery, that's the very racialized ideas that many whites hold on to.
Yeah.
It's striking, though, that although many people of color fear the police, there are also polls that show that substantial numbers of people of color also support the police as an institution.
Yeah, and partly it's because of this idea of no alternative, right? There's no alternative. And it's also true that, I mean, every time I talk to people about police, there's always someone, and rightfully so, who's going to say, well, yeah, but, I mean, I'm a victim of crime, or someone in my family was a victim of crime, and who else can I turn to other than police to guarantee my or their safety? And sure, it's not perfect, and of course it could be better, but there was no alternative. And it's this idea of no alternative that is important to really get at, that there are alternatives, that there are other ways to organize our sort of collective safety and security. And when we really look empirically at police, it's pretty easy to point out that only some people are safe and secure because of police. When I was involved in anti-police violence organizing in Albuquerque after the police killing of James Boyd in 2014, you know, I really remember vividly this. I was at a meeting, and this prominent white member of the community stood up, and he said, you know, I'm really scared now when I drive home from work in my Prius to the Heights, this sort of like upper class part of town, because I'm fearful police will pull me over and kill me. And, you know, at the time, at that moment, that wasn't absurd and laughable. There was this sort of potent fear, I think, generally about the way the Albuquerque Police Department operated. And that, you know, that fear resolved itself fairly quickly among, you know, white, wealthy residents of Albuquerque who came to realize after a while, well, yeah, actually, you know, I'm safe, and, you know, my community is fairly safe and secure. And that didn't change for the sort of working class communities, you know, populated largely by people of color, who remain fearful of police. Right? So I'm not surprised when people point out to me, what else can we do? You know, I mean, it's like there's no alternative. And that's not even to mention the fact that most people have cops in their family, right? And so it's like, well, you know, my brother's a cop and he's nice, or my uncle's a cop and he seems like a nice person, and so maybe you're over-exaggerating and maybe you're not fairly depicting police. And that's, you know, I think that's a function of constantly, you know, when we talk about police, thinking of some person in uniform rather than thinking of an institution, and forgetting that, you know, people don't change institutions. Institutions change people often, and therefore you can go into, you know, the police. You can want to help and become a cop, and then be shocked by what you find yourself doing, because it's about imposing an order that requires the use of great violence often, or the threat of violence. That's what cops do, and that we have to remember that when we want to talk about building an alternative to police.
Well, that tricky aspect of the police being part of the working class, one of the places that conundrum comes up and that you and your co-author write about in Police, a Field Guide, is around police unions. Can you explain how you understand the role of police unions? Usually those of us on the left are ready to support unions, but police unions seem to play a distinctive role.
Yeah, first of all, police, if we're going to talk about individual cops, we might say that they probably are, in sort of economic terms, working class, in a sort of like abstract way. But police unions demonstrate no solidarity with the working class in general, and certainly no solidarity with other unions. In fact, the origins of police unions come out of the anti-union busting activities of cops. And the sort of the role that cops played in cracking down and on civil rights activists in the Jim Crow South, and union-busting tactics in the North, both private police in the 1800s and early 1900s, and then municipal police after that. And it became really obvious to police that, you know, forming unions served this dual feature. Number one, it, you know, served their collective interest as workers. So in that sense, police unions are kind, you know, they're collectives of workers who have a shared economic interest and express that shared interest through their union. But the formation of unions also served to actually disguise what it is that police have historically done and continue to do, which is to actually work in opposition to the interests of other workers and the working class more generally. So we have to be really wary when we think about the police as members of the working class, because, you know, the police operate to defend the interests generally of those who are not, who don't have shared interests to the working class, and defend property rights and impose restrictions on worker rights. And those, you know, there's no way that that's consistent with what we would expect as the solidarity we need from unions generally in the working class. So, you know, but police unions, by the way, are very effective. I mean, they're among the most well-organized public sector unions in the U.S. They're very effective at, like, representing their members. And they also are mostly really good at reminding the communities in which they find themselves how important they are, and how absolutely essential police are. And so, you know, if you go to any city council meeting when they're talking about police salaries, I mean, they have the largest voices and are very influential. You know, in Albuquerque, I can't open the newspaper without there being an article quoting the police union representative talking about the need for higher salaries for police, and, you know, and being very effective at that. So they look like unions. They appear to represent their members in a way that are similar to other kinds of unions, but there's, you know, their interests are actually opposed to the interests of the working class more generally.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with David Correa. He's co-author with Tyler Wall of Police, a Field Guide. That's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. David Correa is associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. So one of the things that your book does is enumerates the weapons, in broad terms, that the police deploy to impose the sort of social order and racial order that they do. And I wonder if you could tell us about the origin of the taser. That is one weapon that we associate with the police. How did that come about?
Yeah, the taser, it's not an accident that it's like a cattle prod, because the first electronic currency weapons similar to tasers were actual cattle prods. And the company, the most common taser in use by cops is by a company formerly called Taser International. And, you know, the guy that invented it, you know, was inspired by, like, science fiction novels and was watching the Watts riots in 1965 and imagined some way in which, you know, police could have some weapon. It would be a kind of crowd control weapon, and, you know, it presented this as a kind of, like, reform weapon, a non-lethal thing. It wouldn't leave the, you know, up until that point, cops were using billy clubs and their weapon, their service revolvers, and, you know, leaving literally bloody battlefields behind them, and when they were engaged in union busting fights or against civil rights marchers. And so the taser was this solution to an intractable problem for police, which was, like, how do we control unruly crowds? And, you know, so any gathering, any crowd to police is an unruly or potentially unruly crowd. And so the taser becomes this sort of, like, magical weapon that police can use to suddenly be more effective in these crowd control, in the moments they need crowd control, and not resort to lethal weapon. That was the promise. So this taser is really effective. and it promises to give police powers that, you know, prior to the use of tasers, they wouldn't have had. And but it's hardly the non-lethal weapon that police promise it to be. I mean, there's been scores and scores of deaths in the U.S. alone in the last 15 years through the use of tasers. Like any weapon, like any claimed non-lethal weapon that police use, there are only very, very specific kinds of circumstances under which it is non-lethal. And so the taser is often used in ways that contribute to a lethality that they claim doesn't exist with it. And in fact, there's like the cops have special words to describe what happens to people when they die in encounters with cops who use tasers. And it's usually there's something wrong with the person. They you know, excited delirium syndrome is this phrase that cops have used, which no doctor would admit to being a legitimate condition, but which cops and courts have said, well, the person died as a result of this taser injury, not because of the misuse of the taser, but because they suffer from something called excited delirium syndrome that leaves them susceptible to major injury as a result of the taser. And, you know, so in other words, if you're nervous, if you're anxious, if your heart rate is up, if you're acting erratically, those are the circumstances under which a taser might be fatal. As though no one already feels that way when they're when they encounter a cop who's about to use a taser on them.
Indeed.
And these are the ways that, like, so the taser is this completely lethal weapon that we are told is non-lethal and actually solves this sort of like serious problem of police lethality, and we should be happy with the use of the taser. But in reality, it's a weapon like any other weapon that is used and misused and leads to deaths, and we shouldn't be surprised about that. And we shouldn't and calls for reforms that rely on the taser are really only forms of reform that just serve the interests of expanding police powers more generally. Anyways, so now police just have multiple choices of weapons, all of which are designed to do great harm and use great pain in their application.
Well, another weapon which is classified as less than lethal is tear gas. Tear gas is meant to be not lethal, used under particular circumstances. What are those circumstances?
Yeah, tear gas, I mean, there are very specific circumstances under which tear gas is not lethal, and none of those circumstances describe the way cops use tear gas. I mean, you know, you'd have to be in an open ventilated place and have access to water so you could clear eyes and clear it out of your system. Please weaponize tear gas, right? They fire it from canisters, so they're blunt trauma injuries to people who are hit by those canisters. You know, they often use them in closed spaces so that there's no escape from the sort of intense amount of tear gas that police use. You know, police are indiscriminate often in the use of tear gas, whether there's children, right, or pregnant women, of course, who are particularly susceptible for to injuries related to tear gas. And so, you know, it's not an accident that, well, police may call it an accident, but it's not an accident that there are, of course, fatalities and serious injuries related to tear gas. I mean, if you recall the Occupy protests at the University of California, Davis, or the 1999 WTO protests, where police were pulling off, you know, protesters' face masks and spraying tear gas directly into their faces at close range, this is not how we're promised tear gas is used by police, because these are particularly the kinds of tactics that lead to permanent injuries or fatal injuries. And, of course, tear gas, by the way, is banned as a weapon of war, but allowed to be used by police all over the world. And the logic of this is that, well, combatants in war wouldn't really be able to know whether tear gas is sort of basic CS gas or maybe poison gas, whereas protesters on the street can be assured that when police use tear gas, they're using the benign version that isn't poison gas, which is a real logical leap that relies on the premise that, police have our interests at heart, and police would not engage in tactics that actually expose us to risks in ways that they do. And so tear gas ends up being another one of these sort of reform tools, these weapons that promise some sort of less lethal outcome, but in practice, because of the way that police use it, it's no different than the taser or the service weapon or any other weapon that police use. It has no less lethal than anything else that police use.
Another weapon of the police, which is much less obvious as a weapon, is the Rough Ride, which Freddie Gray fatally received in Baltimore in 2015. Can you tell us what the Rough Ride is and why it is so dangerous?
Yeah, the Rough Ride, it's what they call it in Baltimore. They call it a nickel ride in Philly. Every cop everywhere uses some version of it. What happened to Freddie Gray was this sort of the version of it that people are probably familiar with because of Freddie Gray, where, you know, the cops will grab somebody and throw them into the back of a paddy wagon or a police van, and that person is probably, as Freddie Gray was, handcuffed with his hands behind his back, sometimes legs shackled together, and then not secured in the van. So, you know, if you've ever been in the back of a police van, you know this is just a metal box with sharp edges on everything, and there are often seat restraints. But the point of the Rough Ride is to deliver what's called street justice, so the person is not secured in there, and then the officer drives erratically and at high speeds. They drove Freddie Gray around Baltimore for like an hour, erratically stopping, speeding and then stopping, and driving at high speeds. And Freddie Gray had no way to protect himself in the back of the wagon, and so he was flying all over. And by the time they got to the Western District Station in Baltimore, his spine was severed, and he died later at the hospital. I've talked to people on the street in Albuquerque who've described similar things, where they're thrown into the back of a police cruiser, their hands cuffed behind them, and then the cop will drive erratically as they just are just ricocheting around the back. And it's intended as a way to deliver a beating without having to do it oneself. I mean, that's the point of the Rough Ride. And as we point out in the book, you know, the way that the media, particularly in the wake of Freddie Gray's death, depicted, it's a kind of like, it's a kind of like unspoken tactic that cops will use, right? It's someone gives you lip, give them a rough ride. Someone's not polite, back in the wagon, let's give them a rough ride, or her a rough ride. And you know, the question we ask is, you know, what does it say about police that the camaraderie, the unspoken language that the cops speak to someone is a language that requires great suffering by those people that they arrest or they capture. I think what that suggests is that, you know, the Rough Ride is not some sort of aberration. It doesn't describe some sort of the actions of a few bad apples, but rather it really structurally explains how police are organized and what police see the job as. It's delivering a beating. It's delivering a punishment, because that's what cops can do, and that person deserves it somehow. And cops are required to do it. Right? It becomes part of the job. I've talked to many former cops who've chosen not to be cops, who've described those moments when it's expected that they use their service weapon. It's expected that they engage in this kind of extra legal punishment. And if they don't, it's made clear to them that that's the job of police, and the fact that you don't do it is a risk to the rest of us who do engage in this practice. So, the fact that it has a name and we think of it as relating to a specific place, I think disguises the fact that this is a practice widely. It's not unusual. Every cop has either done it or knows a cop who's done it, even if they don't even think it's wrong. This is as common as the traffic ticket.
David Corray is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about his book, Police, A Field Guide. One of the things that you write about in the book is sexual violence from the police. And you write that rape is the second most frequent complaint against the police. Tell us about rape as a weapon of sorts, as you see it, of police violence.
Yeah, I mean, I this is a hard one for people to consider, because we have to first understand rape is part of a larger practice of terror that police use to, as we keep people in their place. For example, I was on the street interviewing homeless people a few years ago, and particularly talking to Native trans women in Albuquerque or on the street, and the idea that they might not have confronted sexual violence by police was like this laughable idea. And anyone who would talk to me on the street thought it silly that I was even asking the question, that it was such a common part of the violent encounter that particularly, at least in Albuquerque, Native trans women on the street experience when they come into contact with police. And of course, if you're living on the street, you're always coming into contact with police. And it's one of those that, it's never framed as a form of sexual terror. It's often just this, this aberration. It's so shocking, so unbelievable as to be impossible to picture as a sort of common or regular practice. I mean, I think particularly our writing about rape as a practice of sexual terror by police is one of the reasons why cops really hate this book. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why police don't like this book, but that one has really, I think, for them, has gone too far. But when you look at the numbers and you see, researchers who are really interested in what kind of complaints are lodged against the police, sexual violence is a common complaint lodged against police. And by the way, I would say that all complaints lodged against police can only possibly constitute a small minority of all the sort of problems that we might identify by police. I mean, it's very difficult to complain, number one. You put yourself at great risk often when you're complaining publicly about police, because often the only person to complain to is the police institution of individual cops. So the fact that it's so common tells us something about the structural nature of this as a key tactic. And so, particularly feminist scholars are quick to point out that, this is supposed to be the institution that someone would turn to who needs safety and security, and it ends up being the very institution that exploits that, which are police. And, so in the entry on rape, and also, by the way, the entry on strip search, we have an entry on strip search, which we point out is kind of like a version of a state-sanctioned rape. You realize that this is a really common practice. I mean, the strip search itself is shocking.
This is the body cavity search, both men and women are subjected to.
Yeah, and it's like, if we just describe the practice, it's a form of rape. And any legal definition of rape would include what police do or jailers do when they engage in a body cavity search. The unwanted, particularly for women, but not only for women, penetration of sexual organs, that's what police do, and it's common. And there have been exposés every now and then, the most famous one in Chicago in the 70s, about the sort of common way in which the Chicago Police Department used body cavity searches and strip searches of women for even like basic traffic tickets, right? Just a traffic violation, and they would engage in this body cavity search, this forced, unwanted body cavity search. What is this if not state rape, we ask in the book? But of course, law sees it as essential to securing the safety and security of society more generally, and gives to police the authority, in fact, wide authority. I mean, it's legal for a cop to engage in a body cavity search, a forced body cavity search of someone without a warrant. They couldn't look in your pockets. They couldn't look in your trunk of your car legally without reasonable suspicion, but they could engage in a body cavity search without that same level of legal standard. And so I think we have to understand sexual violence as a real organizing principle of police when we're talking about how they fabricate order.
Well, let's finish by talking about police reform. Listeners might hear what you've just been talking about body cavity searches, and think, well, that is clearly something that needs to be reformed, even if the police themselves as an institution are problematic. Shouldn't we attempt to rein in some of these most egregious aspects of policing while working toward, as you would argue, an alternative to the police as an institution?
Well, I think that's often how it starts. I mean, you would consider, take any city that has recently been in the news, whether it's New York or Sacramento or L.A. or Baltimore or Ferguson, Missouri, this desire to confront this problem asks those kinds of questions, but it often then gives way to this official narrative, which is really all about restoring the legitimacy of police. Police reform really doesn't have anything to do with confronting the real problems that we've just been talking about today. It's all about restoring the legitimacy of the police more generally. And that language is clear. I mean, if you just read any police reform, any article about police reform in any newspaper, and there's going to be some police commissioner or police union official or elected official who's going to say something about, well, we really have to restore the public's trust in police. And that's what reform is really about. And the ways that happens are almost the same everywhere. I mean, there's this idea about, well, let's get rid of the bad apples, which means, raise our hiring standards and improve our training. And then there's usually let's get rid of the bad leadership. So it's going to fire some cops and we're going to bring in some new leaders. And then it's going to be like, well, let's offer cops alternatives to lethal weapons. And so, the expansion of things like the uses of taser and canine dogs, which also, and my co-author Tyler Wall writes about the use of dogs. These are supposed to be tools that, that cops can draw on so that these encounters are not so often lethal. And, maybe it could improve the way that cops use these weapons. Or, often the language is, well, we need more community policing. And I would, we're really, in this book, very suspicious of all language of community policing, because to us, and I think, we make the argument that this is a form of counterinsurgency. Community policing is often about really, at a fine-grained level, forcing a kind of restored legitimacy of police by embedding police into the community, which is about just, expanding the ability of police to surveil, to expand the police powers more generally into our everyday lives. And I can't think of any police reform procedure that has ever led to what we might call this totally reformed police department that now doesn't engage in all these problems that we've seen before. The history of police in this country, as my co-author Tyler Wall likes to say, is crisis, reform, crisis. Right? It's like some crisis, some spectacular example of police violence, followed by uproar and anger, followed by police reform, followed, and then just repeat. The process happens all over again. And so, when we think about police reform, then, we're not thinking about confronting the problem of police violence more generally. And, there's ways to, neither Tyler nor myself are suggesting for 1 minute that we should do nothing. I think we should support all proposals that lead to the less, cops using fewer weapons and having less access to weapons. Any proposals that reduce the size and scope of police powers more generally. We should support any proposals that actually shift the actual job of policing to non-police. We should support, and these are all ways to try to These are kind of alternatives, I think, that bring us in a direction that might not lead to what we usually get with standard establishment police reform, which is often more police, more weapons, more aggressive policing generally. That's in Albuquerque after 2014, when this city exploded after the police killing of James Boyd, the response, even with the presence of the Department of Justice in town forcing reforms, is now this drumbeat for we need more cops, and they need to have more discretion, and those cops need to, well, of course, they'll have better training, and everything will be fine in that regard. But without it, there's no safety and security. So all that anger gets resolved into more cops, more weapons, more policing. That's what reform does. That's establishment reform. And we write quite a bit in the book about the pitfalls of that, and we're trying to make sure that our readers understand what cops mean when they talk about police reform, because it's not about confronting. Police reform is about you and me, not cops. It's about getting you and me to submit to police and policing more generally and more willingly, because we might somehow be led to believe it's nicer and gentler and reformed, when in fact all it is about changing this sort of relationship the police have with us so that we are better police subjects.
And the book in question is Police, A Field Guide. It is co-authored by David Correa, my guest today, and Tyler Wall, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. David Correa teaches in the Department of American Studies at the University of New Mexico, and his other books include Properties of Violence. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.